One evening, not too very long ago, relatively speaking, two sisters were preparing for a very special dinner guest. He was a powerful teacher, someone who radiated wisdom and love. Each of these two sisters prepared for this guest's arrival in their own way. The one sister, Martha, she was known for her accomplishments and her work ethic, which is why she started by making a thorough to-do list. Once she understood the scope of the tasks ahead, she got to work, cleaning the kitchen and the dining area, dusting and sweeping and mopping, doing the grocery shopping, setting the table, and then chopping and broiling and heating and stirring. Since this particular guest made a habit of traveling with at least 12 of his closest friends, it was a big meal to put together. And the timing had to be just right. It all had to be just right. Martha's sister, on the other hand, Mary, if Mary was known at all, it would have been less for what she did than kind of how she was. She was often quiet. You may not notice her near you, but for the way she listened. She listened, and you could feel her listening. Accordingly, Mary's preparation took an entirely different course than her sister's. While Martha cooked, Mary waited. Just waited. Hopeful and watchful, she paid attention. She breathed deeply. She smiled broadly. She walked softly. She offered thanks. She prayed. She felt blessed. Finally, the time arrived. The guest, Jesus was his name. He was grateful and unassuming. Martha was the first to greet him at the door, always one for good manners. She brought him in, found a place for him and all of his companions to sit, and then went back to her work. There was still a lot to do. She was nervous and unsure. She wanted Jesus to see her, to appreciate all that she had done, to believe that she was a good person, good enough to have someone like him in her home for dinner, good enough to be in the presence of the holy. So she returned to her pots and her hot oven and kept working. Meanwhile, her sister Mary sat at Jesus' feet and began to listen as he spoke. And she did, as she sat there, she did absolutely nothing else. Though she tried not to make it obvious, Martha saw all of this and she was not happy. She was irritated in that way that only siblings can get irritated with one another. You know, primordially, viscerally, irrationally, where one small irritation stands in for a lifetime of jealousy and fear or love. From this place, Martha stirred her soup around and around and picking up the pace as each thought came to her. Who does Mary think she is? Jesus must think she is so rude. She is such an embarrassment. And wouldn't I like to sit there all still and quiet, learning all there is to learn, thinking big thoughts, dreaming big dreams. Wouldn't that be nice? But then who would be making the dinner? As she stirred these words that were in her head, suddenly she found them coming out of her mouth. You know those moments. And suddenly she heard the sound of her own voice. Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the work by myself? Tell her to help me. The chatter in the room came suddenly to a terrible, awkward silence. Jesus had been watching this whole thing the whole time, the stirring, the tending, the sighing. So it did not take him long to respond. Martha, Martha, you are worried and distracted by many things, but there is need of only one thing. And the whole room was like, what is it? And for real, he never said. Religious scholars and Bible readers for centuries have puzzled over this passage in the 10th chapter in the Gospel of Luke, but still no one can say conclusively what Martha does not have, but Mary clearly does. It also does not say what Jesus planned on eating if everyone followed Mary's or his example. But it is a fitting ending for a story that is about time and how we spend our time. Because how we spend our time always seems to come with this like generic sense that no matter how we're doing it, we must be doing it wrong. Like everyone else has figured out the secret, that one thing that's going to make time make total sense. I say all of this as someone who has, for most of my life, been utterly confused about time. I don't actually believe that all of you, everyone has figured out all of that one thing or the secret, but I do think you have a little bit more of a handle on it than I do. See, I come from some of this confusion is in my inheritance. My mom's family, she was one of seven. They lived next door to the town school. It was one school. They lived next door. There wasn't any other neighbors around, and yet that family of seven, they were always the last to arrive. The teachers and the other kids liked to make a joke of it to my mom and her siblings, but she and they did not find it very funny. It was actually really embarrassing, especially because they didn't feel like they had a lot of control over it, really. There were reasons in her childhood home why getting out the door and then getting across the playground was harder than it might seem. Some of it was just the chaos of seven kids. They were born in the span of 9 years, so two sets of twins in there. Some of it, though, was the chaos that her parents inherited from their parents, and then from theirs, and from theirs. All of this generational chaos adds up to what I sometimes think about for myself as my time disability. As in, my inner clock just does not match up to the actual clock. How long I think things will take and how long they actually take, how many hours there are in a real day, how many days in a month, how many months in the year, I am literally shocked at how off I can be. Some of you, I just apologize. I know you have experienced this from me personally. I am not young. I should be better at this by now. I acknowledge that my time challenges are not helped by my innate, insatiable ambition to do all the things. I remember in fourth grade, I was 9 years old, and my school decided they'd started an advice column in the school newspaper, and I knew right away that I needed to write a letter for advice. I was so hopeful that they would finally help me solve my problem. I wrote, "My problem is I can't choose. I want to do soccer and piano and tennis and swimming and basketball and campfire girls, and also I play guitar in the church choir and volunteer with my family. I ride bikes with my sisters, and I always need the extra time with my homework because I love all the bonus assignments." My letter went on for multiple pages. And at the end, my question was simply, "I just don't know how to fit it all in. I want to do it all, but there isn't enough time. What do I do?" Time, it's like money. It is a limited resource. But also, like money, the way we spend it tells us what we value most, whether we mean it to or not. Because we cannot spend it on everything, and there are no do-overs. Even at 9, I understood this. Until finally that real-life invention of Hermione Granger's time turner. Don't you want one of those? But for now, until we got one of those, we're all stuck with a limited number of hours in each day. Days in each week, weeks in each year, moments in a life, which is sometimes the worst, but also sometimes the best news I know. Time is passing. Even now. Even now. Time is passing. In seminary, I discovered that at least some of my confusion with time might be a matter of linguistics. See, in English, we only have one word for this idea of time, but the ancient Greeks actually gave it two words, chronos and kairos. These are words that describe two totally different realities, different experiences that encompass the one thing that we call time. Chronos refers to the actual clock time. It's the sort that Martha was really anxious about, but Mary seemed to be clueless about. Chronos is the getting the dinner done and served hot at an already set table. It's hanging out through two stoplights at Prospect because the students are back and the construction's not done. And it's sitting in the waiting room until the nurse calls your name. As author Glennon Doyle writes, Chronos time is 10 excruciating minutes in the Target line when one kid has swiped the bra out of the cart and arranged it over her sweater while sucking on a lollipop undoubtedly found on the ground, while the other kid is sucking on the pen from the credit card machine while the woman ahead of you in line is trying to use it. Chronos is 4 screaming minutes in a timeout. And it's 2 hours till daddy gets home. Chronos is the hard, slow passing of time that many of us actually live in. Kairos, on the other hand, is time in the larger sense. It's time out of time. It's what mystic Julian of Norwich understood when she said, all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. Kairos is what some call God's time. Glennon Doyle describes Kairos as that same 10 minutes in Target, but for a moment in the midst of all those things going on, you notice the piles of healthy food in your cart, the food that you'll feed your children to grow their bodies and minds, and you remember that most of the world's mamas would kill for this opportunity, this chance to stand in the grocery line with enough money to pay. And you just stare at your cart and the abundance and say, thank you. Mary was connected to Kairos entirely, gave herself over to it. Martha, she was nowhere near. Martha, Martha, you are worried and distracted by many things. Which I have to say, I think is like the most annoying comment ever. I mean, she was making him dinner, and her sister was completely unhelpful. She was making dinner for him and his 12 friends. You are worried and distracted. Worried and distracted seems the least of what she had every right to be. Now, a lot of the traditional reads on this story cast these two sisters as a dichotomy of life choices, like a choice between Mary's being and Martha's doing. A choice of contemplation or action, chronos or kairos. As you can probably guess, given Jesus' admonishment, the celebrated path traditionally has not trended towards Martha in this dichotomy. Be a Mary, not a Martha, this the usual lesson goes. But even though Martha was getting the job done all on her own. Now, some feminist readings have tried to rescue Martha over the years, but more often, the feminist insight has actually centered on Mary, because she's a woman who is not in the kitchen, right? And Jesus was all, follow her. Martha, on the other hand, has been portrayed as a cautionary tale of overwork, overworry, and overfunctioning. And in today's world, where busy has become like a status symbol, it is a message that many of us need to really know that we need not work for our worth, that we need not show we are worthy of being present in the presence of the holy by how much we can get done. Have you noticed lately that when you ask people, how are you, the common answer is busy? Which, I mean, busy is not a feeling word. Behind the busy, however, there might be all sorts of feelings, from loneliness to fear, to excitement, to exhaustion, even wonder or boredom or despair. The only thing we know for sure with busy is that we do not know, because who has the time? There's just so much to do. We're so busy. To address this Martha-esque epidemic of modern life, this conventional wisdom tells us that we need to be seeking more balance, as in work-life balance, activity-rest balance, care for others, care for self balance. Now, I think this is a little better than casting off Martha entirely. I mean, who would be making the dinner? But it still represents the way we think about our time as a dichotomy. It's just that instead of choosing one or the other, we're invited to kind of straddle across, to arrange our time as if placing pieces of ourselves on a scale, measuring and quantifying. Okay, did I get enough work time this week to balance out my home time, my rest time with my activity time, my care for others with my care for myself time, my serving, my relaxing? But life does not actually separate out like this, really. Life is much more mixed up, less a dichotomy and more what I call a big, messy paradox. Because life, on the one hand, is about target lines and lollipops and dealing with the clogged kitchen sink. Life is being too hot and not being able to figure out how to turn the heat off. Life is picking up the groceries and in the middle of everything, the bag breaking. Life is spilling coffee down your sleeve, buying a hairbrush, hurrying along wobbly bricks, parking and slamming the car door shut in the cold. All of these things, these daily things, these things that are our hours and our minutes, our seconds, they are life. And then at the exact same time, life is not actually about the kitchen sink or the groceries or even the coffee. It isn't about any of these things at all. Life is instead about this thread that connects all of these things and about all of us doing all of these things. It is about that connection, that pulse that flows through all of them. It is that yearning. Life is sometimes even about the not getting the things done, about setting aside all the cooking to sit in a circle of friends who've decided to dedicate their lives to love and trusting that there is a different sort of hunger to feed. Life is doing, but because of being. Life is tending and tasking and tracking, but because of who we are tending and tasking and tracking for. Because always in the next room or the next house or the next city sits our beloved, and all of our tasks that keep us often too worried and too distracted, really, they add up to something we might call healing and liberation, wholeness and transformation. Which is why I vote that we give up on the whole idea of balance. And not just because I'm terrible at it. But because it is the wrong thing to tell a 9-year-old who is extremely passionate about life. And it's the wrong thing to tell any of us who hope to live whole lives of passion and purpose and meaning. Because the point of life is not really to construct perfectly equal doses of being and doing, resting and working, marrying and murthering. We're not here to be well-balanced. We're here to live, which takes the everyday. We are here to create in that everyday, that rhythm that connects us to all the parts, chronos, kairos, rest, work, joy, struggle. The task is not to create the balanced life, but the integrated life, the whole life, a life lived with intention, where we can show up all the way in all the things. Which is not to say that my fourth grade advice giver was wrong about needing to give some things up. That was the response back. I was like, but time, it is a limited resource. I've said it like 3 times in the sermon because I think the more that I say it, the more it keeps sinking in. Time is a limited resource. It's just that the question, as Parker Palmer asks, is not just what do I want to let go of, but also what do I want to give myself to? How we spend our time is how we're living, giving our lives to. It's what we're giving our lives to. And so the task is to intentionally choose a worthy vision and to keep connected in each of those choices to that big why behind it all. You might even say that one thing. Even when we're standing over the hot stove, even when a family member is driving us crazy, even when we're running late, even when we know there's more to do than we possibly cannot get done, to keep weaving there that connection over and over and over, second by second, minute by minute, connecting to that one thing. To accept this moment as it is, and to remember that the holy is always there within our reach, and to surrender finally to all that we cannot control and trust that life finds a way to persist, usually not because of our plans, but in spite of them, and to give thanks that we can be simply a part, to give thanks that we have this chance simply and right now to live. May it be so, and amen.